Good. You ready? Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. With that gavel, I have just convened the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development for March the 20th, 2017. We are gathered today for the purpose of a public hearing on House Bill 5012, Housing and Community Services Department. We have an awful lot of people signed up. There are going to be folks in and out of this committee this morning. It has, or this afternoon, it has nothing to do with any of you. It has to do with the fact that many of us are required to testify on some different bills. That's where Senator Hansel is. That's where Representative Gomberg is. It's where I'm going to go in a second. So this is not meant to be disrespectful. It's just we're trying to be in a couple of places at once. We have a whole bunch of people signed up, and in order to get through them, we're probably going to have to limit testimony to a couple of minutes. If you've got written testimony, please feel free to submit it to the professional staff, and they will get it. If many of you are saying the same thing, you could come up in a panel, and not all of you have to testify. That will allow a little extra time. So with that, Ms. Deister, will you give us the batting lineup, and then I'm going to excuse myself, run down and testify, and come back.
Okay. The batting lineup is as follows. Housing and Community Services is scheduled to finish walking quickly through their policy option packages. Then we will hear from the Department of Administrative Services with their overview of the governor's budget, and then, of course, open it up for public testimony, which is scheduled today. Everyone who has submitted written testimony, that should all be up on OLIS already for you to take a look at. So,
and is our habit, we will take testimony from those that have come the farthest distance first. So with that, we'll invite the agency back up. I'm going to briefly excuse myself, and we will be back together.
Okay.
Who's your proxy today? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much, co-chair and members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Margaret Salazar, and I'm director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And just as a refresher, over the last couple of days of testimony, we gave you an overview of our agency's budget summary, environmental factors. We provided some data for you with the analysis of some of the housing issues across the state. And then we also provided a detailed summary of our programs. We also talked about the federal budget climate and some of the information that came out last week regarding the president's federal budget blueprint and the impacts that that would have on our agency's programs. So today we were hoping to wrap up our presentation by giving you a brief overview of our policy option packages, talking briefly about some of the proposed housing legislation and how that might impact our agency, and some of the reduction options as well for HCS. So in a moment, we'll go over some of the details of our policy option packages. But just as an overview for you, a few of the things that we wanted to emphasize. We are proposing some additional staffing for the department to be able to effectively stand up new programs. Some of the programs we touched on in our presentation last week, including the new LIFT program, the mental health housing program, some increased single family work, as well as data and research work for our agency. So primarily the additional staffing resources would help us to deliver effectively these new programs, to be able to expand our mission and better address the housing crisis facing Oregonians, and finally to address some of the operational shortcomings that were identified in the Secretary of State performance audit. We've strategically proposed staffing to try to address our operations, the issues identified in the audit, and as I mentioned, to expand our mission. So I'm now going to invite our CFO, Caleb Yant, to talk through the policy option packages in additional detail. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Salazar, members of the committee. Again, my name is Caleb Yant. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And Margaret teed it up pretty well. I'm going to try to move through these pretty quickly because, as was noted, there are a number of people behind me who will be providing public testimony. And a lot of these items we touched on Wednesday and Thursday of our presentation last week. So I'll move pretty quickly, but of course, stop me wherever is needed. So the first package here is the CFO analyst package. These are a few of the highlights of what moving from agency request budget to the governor's budget. The big item that I will highlight here is, as we noted in our presentation, the governor's budget proposes an additional $60 million for the Local Innovation and Fast Track Housing Program, the LIFT program. And it also includes $10 million in lottery-backed bonds for preservation of affordable housing. So there are a few other funding adjustments here, but those are the big items on that package. The next two packages here really speak to those staffing needs that Director Salazar just noted. So the first package and our highest priority was related to the LIFT program. And really this is to provide us the staffing to both underwrite these deals as well as monitor them over the life of the projects that we build with this funding. So that's that first package. The second package really is those staffing needs. And so on Wednesday, I talked about how there are 10 additional positions in the 2017-19 governor's budget over 15-17 biennium. Four of those are related to new program development. Six of them are really right here. So there's two positions within our multifamily finance development section. There's two within the single family to really add capacity and expand on our Oregon bond program, and two within data and research, really getting at some of those key findings within the Secretary of State audit.
Mr. Chair.
Representative
Meeks. I apologize to stop and ask you this, but the public right now is asking us to tighten our belts. And when I look and see that we have three new positions, two FTE, but it's going to cost us $700,000, can you give me, I don't know if I've seen the underlying budget of this, but what are we getting for that?
Representative Meek, that this is, so the limited duration staffing is underwriting throughout the whole biennium. So that's work that is currently being done now. It crosses the whole biennium. And it's some of the professional services, some of the DOJ and other attorney charges associated with this new program. And then the two permanent positions phase in over the course of the biennium. So there's one that really monitors a property to make sure it meets the health and safety and other compliance, and one providing operational oversight, which is something that is completely new to us that we haven't done before.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yep.
So the next package is related to the $10 million in lottery-backed bonds that is in the governor's budget. So we already covered that. Again, I'm moving pretty quickly just for time constraints. Package 108 is related to the Oregon Homeownership Stabilization Initiative. This is $95 million that we got in one-time federal funds from the U.S. Treasury that we received in 2016. This is a limited duration program and limited duration positions, and so it's just reestablishing these limited duration positions within this biennium. Package 109, again, is a temporary program, and so it is limited duration positions that are in 15-17 that are bringing it into 17-19. I'll note that one is a permanent position now that is paid for by other funds, and that is to process the rental payments associated with this over the life of these projects. The package 110 is the Elderly Rental Assistance Program. That is the program that came over from the Department of Revenue to Housing and Community Services, new for the 17-19 biennium. So those were the packages that were in our budget. Quickly, I'll kind of highlight a few areas in the pending legislation. As noted earlier in our budget presentation, there are a lot of bills that change or provide new programs that impact our agency. And so there's two things that I'll note. One is there are items that are bolded through each of these slides. Those are new programs to OHCS, so we bolded them to kind of provide that distinction. The other thing that you'll note is we group them into categories just so you kind of have an idea. So I'm not going to walk through each one of these because it's quite an extensive list. But generally, you could see a suite of bills that impact our housing stabilization and the homeless services programs we provide. There's a group that impact energy assistance and our weatherization programs. These are the program areas we walked through on Thursday. single-family programs, and you can see there, the four that are there are bold. There's a number of bills that would provide new programs for homeownership opportunities. Quite a few related to our multifamily housing development programs. And again, I apologize that I'm just kind of going quickly through these. A number that impact manufactured home parks. There are a number of bills, including some new programs related to our tax programs or fees. A number of task forces that we are either going to be staffing or we will be participating in some way. And finally, some kind of general administrative sort of bills that would impact our agency that we're keeping an eye on.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Meek.
Yes, sir. Just a quick question. So with all of the potential legislative changes, is the budget process, have you budgeted to account for any additional duties that you may incur with those?
Representative Meek, this budget does not account for these different changes. As the legislation works its way through, we will get asked for how that would impact our budget, and then we will provide a fiscal impact statement the legislature know how that would impact one way or another our budget.
And Ms. Dyster's going to add on.
Caleb said it very well. Generally speaking, the agency will be asked to evaluate the fiscal implications, give that information to the legislative fiscal office. We will also take a look at that, ask some additional questions, clarifications, and we'll come out with an official fiscal impact statement associated with the bill. If those pieces of legislation make it through the process after this agency's budget, then we can amend those particular policy bills to provide for resources in that vehicle that will then be added to the agency's budget. So that's how
you follow up then, Mr. Chair. So
go ahead.
Well, just Mrs. Dyster. So that each bill, as they come through, they'll come down to a Ways and Means and then, or revenue or no fiscal, see their impact. And if they're passed, then it will be something that would have to be readjusted to these to their current budget, correct?
If they are determined to have a fiscal impact and it appears that they will be moving forward, then yes, they would be adjusted.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you for the clarification. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Rowe?
Yes, Representative Neerman.
Good. Thank you, Chairman Rowe. Let's see.
Give it Dave, you want this?
You're doing fine.
So you have a bunch of policy option packages for underwriters and loan management people. Are those positions scaled to the amount of money that you expect to get? And if so, are they pegged to what your ask is? And then if so, if you get less than your ask, do those scale down?
Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Neerman, they certainly have a capacity, right? And so what we're asking for as far as the underwriting positions for the LIFT program, as well as our two related to the multifamily development, that is based off of the $40 million that we already received for LIFT, and it's based off of kind of our pipeline of the tax credit projects. So as it does not account for the additional $60 million that's in the governor's budget. And as the number of projects grow, there is certainly a limit to the capacity of that underwriting staff.
And if I may add on, Representative and Co-Chair, as Caleb, I think, mentioned, there are some particular startup costs with launching new programs. So there is a certain amount of sort of scale that you could get with additional staffing that you wouldn't necessarily have the full startup capacity need as you add dollars.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. So the final two slides of our presentation really just speak to the 15% reduction options. So of our general fund programs, if we were to take a 15% cut to that, what would that mean? And so that gives you a dollar impact of our general fund programs that are part of the current service level. And then the narrative in here gives you an idea of how that would impact the population that these programs serve.
Okay.
And that is the end of our presentation.
Additional questions? Are you ready to go to public testimony? Mr. Gomberg.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
May I ask one quick question while we're changing gears here?
Please, Representative.
Just for clarification, I'm not used to reading these. On your homeless services, it says something like approximately 5,231 homeless persons would not receive shelter and related services. So is that many people for a year, or is that many people one night each, or what does that really mean? It's on your last, your general fund reduction options.
Yeah, Co-Chair Gomberg, Representative Reardon, I believe that's for the biennium, but we'll need to confirm that. I'll get back to you on that.
Well, I understand the numbers for the biennium, but how many people serve for what length of time is what I'm asking for clarification on.
Representative, we can take a look at those numbers and clarify that for you. It's a little bit challenging because the different, all the different activities within, for example, homeless services, so some of them are more short-term, some of them are longer-term,
yeah.
But we'll try to parse that out in more detail.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Ms. Salazar, before I let you go, and I apologize, everybody, for being late. I think most of you understand this is the time of year where we're expected to be in three places at once. But I didn't want to let you go without asking the question I've been asking everyone. Let's talk a little bit about the uncollected debt that is in your department.
Certainly, Co-Chair.
And I mean, what I'm reading here is that there's about $2.5 million on the books. I would expect that that's mostly from loan payment defaults.
That's right. I'll let our CFO give more detail on that.
Yeah, Co-Chair Gomberg, that's absolutely correct. The very vast majority of, I believe, over 95% of that is related to single-family mortgages from our bond program, and that we pay servicers, local banks, to service that for us, and so they will go through the standard delinquency process and, if required, foreclose on those properties.
Now, while I notice that the amount of debt is fairly constant for you, in fact, you're doing better than most agencies and actually have reduced by a few dollars the amount that you've got on account. What's the consequence of not getting those dollars back in? Does that mean that your overall accounts are reduced, that somebody else down the road is not going to have that money available to them, or that you're asking us to make up the difference? What's the consequence of not getting that money?
Yeah, I think the most direct consequence is that impacts the reserves that we have to hold in our bond indentures to pay for that bad debt. So if we cannot collect on that we end up acquiring those properties through foreclosure and then selling those, and there's costs that the agency would incur in doing that. And then the rate of our foreclosures really very much impacts part of that calculation that we employ financial advisors to look at to see how much we need to hold as far as reserves to cover potential bad debt.
Okay. Any other questions, colleagues? And Ms. Dykstra, I came in late. Do we need to hear from Ms. Wittekind?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Well, she's been very quiet, very patient. I'm also noting that we've got about a dozen people on the list to testify today.
And a couple more over there as well.
So. All right. So we are going to pick up the pace a little bit, but...
Good afternoon, Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Linnea Wittekin. I'm with the DAS Chief Financial Office. I'll be brief. The agency has done a very good job outlining the governor's investments. The governor's budget for housing and community services makes major investments in family affordable housing and multifamily housing, as well as provides continued funding for the Oregon Volunteers and CASA, which is the court-appointed special advocates. Both of these are priorities for the governor, and so she's chosen to make investments in those areas. The biggest changes to note in expenditures from 15-17 to 17-19 is an increase in FTE and a decrease in other funds. The FTE is up in 2017-19 budget due to additional staff needed for the OHSI, as the agency has outlined. Most of these are limited duration positions. The 127 FTE that you see in 15-17 reflects where the agency was at when this program had more or less ramped down. So they're ramping back up, and they've already dedicated most of the funds for 15-17. With the additional round of hardest hit funding, the agency does need to fill these positions. The decrease in other funds is primarily on the non-limited side, where we tried to more closely align the funding level to the residential loan program payments that the agency actually expects to make. This is another look at the budget done by actual expenditure category. The two largest pieces of this pie are the special payments and debt service. Special payments represent program payments such as emergency housing assistance, state homeless assistance, and elderly rental assistance. The debt service activities represent non-limited expenditures that repay investors and other parties' obligations owed on the outstanding debt issued. And just lastly, a quick recap, the governor's budget, $10 million in lottery-backed bond proceeds for multifamily rental housing, and $60 million additional investment in Lyft. And with that, any questions?
Any questions? All right, thank you very much, Ms. Wittekind, and thank you all. We're going to move to public testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to bring up Mr. Thornburg first. That you've got a presentation for us. And
yes.
So if you could introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll move right into it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I'm Kent Thornburg. I'm a scientist at the Oregon Health Science University. I'm a professor of medicine in the Knight Cardiovascular Institute and the director of the Knight Moore Institute for Nutrition and Wellness. I've been asked to be here. I don't see anything on my screen yet.
I've got it here.
But we'll phone a friend for you, and
that is helpful. To look in my pockets.
Yeah.
Oh, I know where it is. It's in his pocket. So while we're loading, let me say that what I would like to present today is to help you understand the biology of why it's so important for people, and especially young people, to have a life that is free from stress because of the detrimental effects of stress.
Tell them not to run for the Senate.
Thank you for your help. I'll go quickly. So first I wanted to tell you a little bit about stress and why this is important. If you look on this chart, you'll see this black line. And that black line represents the stress hormone that all of us have over a 24-hour period. And it goes up. It goes down when we go to bed, and when we wake up, it goes up. And every time we eat a meal, it has a little blip. Now, if you look, you can see that the peak about halfway or two-thirds of the way through is called a stressful event. When we have a stressful event, like our car runs out of gas when we're late for a meeting or something, then our cortisol goes up, and this is the way we cope with it in normal physiology. However, for people who suffer toxic stress, which is called sometimes social stress, their cortisol levels are high all the time. And they don't get much change when they eat meals because it's already so high, and when they have a stressful event, it goes very high. Now, the reason to point this out is particular for women who are pregnant, because during pregnancy, this particular hormone goes across the placenta and suppresses the growth of the baby. And so people who are having housing stress or partner abuse or food insecurity, or women who are pregnant have high levels of this, and this affects their babies, and this is passed on to future generations through mechanisms we call epigenetics that we've just come to understand in the last 20 years. So the outcome of these stresses are low growth of the fetus, more preterm birth, and poor cognitive development in the children. And this leads to heart disease both in the mother and into her offspring. So this curve shows you what all of us were born on this scale somewhere. And it turns out if we're born at the low end of the curve, we're more likely to have heart disease than if we're born in the middle, within the 8 to 9 pound range. So a baby that's born at 5 pounds is 3 to 5 times more likely to have heart disease than one who's born larger because of the way their cardiovascular system is built. Stress leads to suppression of growth, and babies born at that small end have problems in terms of risk for heart disease. And I just want to make one particular point. These small babies also are likely to have low IQ. And this is a very nice study that shows that babies that didn't grow well before they're born, either because their mothers had poor nutrition or because their mothers were stressed and cortisol went across the placenta, in either case, they have less cognitive function for the rest of their lives. And if we have people in our society in large numbers who suffer this, then these people have a hard time doing well in school and have more chronic disease that we have to pay for. So we're most sensitive. If you look across this top bar, this is an entire lifetime of a person. 30,000 days is how long we live on the average, and so I know approximately where I am on that scale. It turns out that over the first 1,000 days is when we're very sensitive to stress and nutrition, and we're less sensitive for the rest of our lives. So during this part, that is what sets our risk for having chronic disease when we're adults. So poor maternal diet, chronic stress, paternal contributions all lead to stress to the baby and leads to an outcome where we are paying the bill for babies later because they have high risk for diabetes, obesity, and heart disease. So I also want to tell you that a lot of research now shows that children who suffer housing stresses have more problems. And one of their problems, I've shown these down there in the red circle, but it turns out that the biggest one we worry most about is higher distress symptoms and lower cognitive function for kids who grew up in a household that have housing stress. And lastly, let me make this point, and that is that we don't try to blame mothers for the fact that they live in an environment where they have poor diets or they live in a stressful environment. It's not the mother's fault. It turns out that the community is the environment of the mother, and we want her to live in a healthy environment, including assurance that she will have housing throughout the life of herself and her child. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thornburg. Any questions? Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. It's fascinating. Earlier slide, you were talking about the birth weight and the mortality rate and so forth. Were you assuming full-term birth weight, and would there be a difference if it was less than full-term?
Yes, thank you for asking. Those data are taken from full-term babies,
okay.
And if we look at preterm babies, for example, they have a higher risk even yet.
Oh,
yeah.
That's good. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Hi, Doctor. At one time, you and I had talked about the possibility of you doing some highly geographically constrained tests on some of your theories. Did you employ any of those going forward?
Yes, one is now going in your district in Astoria.
Okay, I never heard how it closed. I was very excited about it.
It's not closed. It's ongoing, and it's very exciting. And now we have intervention trials for diet and stress for women who are pregnant in that city.
I'd love to know more about it because we talked about it when it was just a concept. I didn't know you'd gone ahead.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Cool. Okay.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Thornburg. I'm going to call up Mark Jolin and Lee Dabrowski and Dan Brown. I've got about 15 people scheduled, so we're going to be looking at roughly 3 minutes per person. If you can do that efficiently, if you use less time, you'll allow more time for somebody behind you. If there's anybody that's traveled more than 100 miles to be with us today, it's not noted on the sign-in sheet, but do let staff know, and we'll make sure that that we get you early in the listings here. So, who'd like to go first?
Shall I go? Please.
All right. Good afternoon, co-chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Mark Jolin. I am the director of the Portland-Multnomah County Joint Office of Homeless Services. We were formed in July of last year to provide a more integrated and streamlined approach to the crisis of homelessness in our community. It's a crisis, as you are all well aware, that is not confined to Portland. It is statewide. In the most recent data released by HUD, Oregon had more than 13,000 homeless people living outside in shelter or transitional housing on a single night. Tens of thousands more Oregonians were involuntarily doubled up on couches and garages and basements. In 2016, we had the highest number of homeless families with children in rural areas of any state. We had the country's fifth highest rate of increase in family homelessness and the highest percentage of unsheltered families in the country. According to the Oregon Department of Education's most recent report, a record 21,340 public school students were homeless last year. And while Portland saw the highest number of homeless students at 1,434, Lincoln County had 768 homeless students, fully 14% of their student population, and the Butte Falls School District in Jackson County reported 35% of their student body had experienced homelessness in the previous year. That is why I am here today asking your support to continue funding two critical programs directly targeted to addressing the homelessness crisis in our state, the Emergency Housing Account, EHA, and the SHAP program. Your support for these programs has always been critical, but never more so than in the past year. In response to the housing crisis, you increased the investment in these two critical programs to $15 million this year, up from $5 million in the first year of the biennium. That funding level has allowed communities around the state to make critical investments in homelessness prevention, helping homeless families return to permanent housing, and in vital emergency shelter capacity. EHA is primarily a prevention and placement program, allowing community action agencies around the state to make extremely cost-effective investments in keeping families from losing their housing and in helping homeless families with the money they need to get back into permanent housing. The SHAP program is a particularly vital resource for funding emergency shelter. In Multnomah County, we are using our EHA allocation primarily for homelessness prevention to help families and children avoid the incredible disruption that comes from being displaced from a home, from a school, and from a community. Unfortunately, the need for prevention assistance is so tremendous that even with the increase in EHA funding, our nonprofits report that they have to turn away as many as 14 of every 15 requests for assistance, and circumstances are not likely to improve anytime soon. Rapidly rising rents create a dire situation for families with children living on minimum and low wages, and for the elderly and disabled who are on limited fixed incomes. In Multnomah County, for example, there are over 18,000 long-term or permanently disabled people who rely on supplemental security income of under $750 a month to survive. With fair market rents on even a studio apartment in the Portland area approaching $1,000 a month, there is simply no housing for these individuals in the private market, and it often takes years to find affordable, subsidized housing. For those families and individuals who are losing their housing, emergency shelter is a critical resource. That is why last year, Portland and Multnomah County embarked on the largest one-year expansion of year-round emergency shelter capacity in memory. We added almost 600 new beds for multiple different populations. While this expansion has been impressive, I can tell you that every bed filled within a week of the shelter's opening and has remained full. In fact, a new family shelter, which was an expansion of a 90-bed winter shelter, filled to 130 people the moment it opened in February of last year, and by November, the nightly census was routinely above 200 people. The shelter capacity is thus critically important, and SHAP funding is essential to keeping the doors to our shelters open. SHAP funding is especially important to our domestic violence shelter system. It funds three different secure location shelters and emergency domestic violence motel vouchers. SHAP and EHA are the primary sources of funding for a new 90-bed women's shelter we opened last year in the city of Gresham. And the newly expanded family shelter that provides day and night shelter to as many as 220 people and families on any given night also relies on SHAP and EHA. Because these two programs are so effective and so urgently needed, maintaining them at their current funding levels is essential to the basic safety and well-being of families in our communities. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. I know that testifying is stressful. We just had a presentation on stress, and it gets more stressful when I tell people that we've got only a limited amount of time. I assure you that your efficient presentation did not lose any of its emotional impact.
Thank you.
So let's move along, and who's going to go next?
I'll go next, if that's all right.
Please.
Thank you.
Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you. Good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity. My name is Lee Dabrowski. I'm the Chief of Police in Hillsborough. I've had the opportunity to work with members of the homeless community for the last 27 years across two states. I'd like to express the support of the City of Hillsborough for increased funding for the Emergency Housing Account and the State Homeless Assistance Fund. Excuse me. Law enforcement in Hillsborough has seen a noticeable increase in the homeless population since I have taken over as chief. We are at the end of the max line, so we're at the stop where many folks decide they'll stay as they look for a place to go. We don't only see single males and females, we also see families. With the increase in the homeless population, we also see a rise in quality of life offenses that increase the call loads on the already limited resources of the Hillsborough Police Department. Not every member of our homeless community commit crime, but it does happen every day. The families that we encounter are living in cars and trailers that they have somehow been able to obtain, and many of the vehicles barely run, if at all. When they do, my officers must move them along because we cannot allow them to live in city parks, private parking lots, or on residential streets, but where are they supposed to go? I'm lucky I have compassionate employees. I actually have numerous stories of officers banding together to try and get resources on their own to help some of these families. Officers passing the hat amongst themselves should not be the answer to homelessness. We do refer our homeless and sometimes transport them to some of the available community resources, but those resources aren't as plentiful as they should be. One of the most frequent stories we hear, especially from homeless families, is how they want employment but cannot get it. Why? Because they don't have the clothing, the place to stay the night and sleep, the place to do something as simple as get a shower. These basics of life that many of us take for granted prevent people from getting jobs and gaining independence. As a city, we expend resources on the homeless every day that were never truly designed for that purpose. The police get called for trespassers who are sleeping in a business doorway. That business can't open until we get there. I just learned our post office has closed its lobby for P.O. box access because it has become a small homeless camp at night. We also respond to a sizable number of calls where members of the homeless community prey upon one another. Theft, assault, domestic violence, and worst of all, sexual assault. Homeless camps are in several areas of our city and are dangerous for all who go to them and who reside in them. We receive calls on a regular basis from our libraries, which are supposed to be the most inviting places on earth. But they must maintain order, and oftentimes some of the members of our homeless community cause disruption to a degree where the police must get involved. We also get calls from Parks and Rec, who must clean up the homeless camps. I already mentioned these camps are dangerous, but they also pose a risk to public health. Much of this could be avoided, and in my estimation, at a lower cost overall to the taxpayer if more homeless resources were available. If I had the opportunity to divert our resources away from the homeless issues, the officers would have more time to engage with all members of our community in a more positive way. Proactive patrol, youth education, mentoring, and spending more quality time on investigation of crime. There would be an immediate downturn in the incident of negative quality of life issues for our entire community. Hillsborough is a welcoming and compassionate community and is doing what it can, but it can't do it all by itself. With additional resources, safe and stable housing would assist the members of our homeless community to become self-sufficient. They could then become productive members of our community and look to help their community as to needing help from it right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Brown, welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to come here today. I'm Dan Brown, the Executive Director of Community Action Team out of St. Helens. We're the community action program that serves Columbia, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. I want to talk to you briefly about the LIFT program, the Local Innovative and Fast Track. We were one of the fortunate recipients of this grant in this last year. It's going to give us the opportunity to build 17 units. These are going to be small, very affordable units. They're going to serve those that are transitioning out of homelessness. These are badly needed in our area. It's an area where the vacancy rate is reported to be somewhere between 1 and 0.25%. So you can imagine how tough of a time we have finding housing for some of our homeless clients. So these are going to serve us. So I appreciate your support of that program. Also want to talk briefly about the emergency housing account. As you've heard support from our other two testifiers as well, this is a critical program for us. We're able to serve families where we would not otherwise be able to serve with this flexible funding. We use it primarily to prevent homelessness and to quickly rehouse those that are already homeless. Our current focus is on prevention. Again, I'm mentioning the housing crisis and not being able to find homes. Or if we can keep them from becoming homeless, we're more efficient that way. These funds have allowed us to prevent evictions for 46 households in this last year. It's also helped us to house an additional 18 homeless families. 6 months into this program, these all remained housed at this time. This is only possible because of the additional $10 million that was given last year. We would certainly encourage that funding amount that would remain the same in the coming years. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yeah, Representative Reardon.
Well, first of all, Mark, thank you very much for your, I think, over 20 years of work on this in this area, and I do appreciate it. Please take this question as one who supports your work. So, given that we have limited resources, are there goals, are there strategies that that aimed at getting the maximum number of units available to serve the homeless?
The maximum number, Representative Reardon, the maximum number of permanent housing units or shelter beds, what did you have in mind?
Either. I wanted people off the streets,
yes.
First of all, and you've talked to me about, you know, getting off the street into shelter and working up the chain. So however you want to describe that, but how do we get the maximum, and is anybody really looking at it that way? Because I wonder.
So we definitely are, Representative, on the shelter side, we definitely are, in the sense that we're trying to find the balance between the number of beds we're providing in any one facility and how effectively we can turn those beds over. Meaning, at some point, if a shelter gets too big, it's hard for the people who are there to feel safe and stabilized enough to be focused on getting out. And so we both want to tailor the populations in our shelters and the sizes of our shelters to maximize the number of people who can effectively transition out and back into permanent housing. So the shelter development work we've done inside of Multnomah County over the last year has kind of had that lens on it. Not just how many beds, but how do we get the maximum number of successful placements out of shelter that we can. So that's a piece of being very efficient with the resource. And then on the permanent housing side, I'm not on the development side of this work, but there's quite a bit of discussion and sort of policy development going on about, you know, how do we bring the cost of development down? How do we explore innovative alternatives to sort of traditional development, revisiting conversations about single room occupancy type of developments that we sort of put on the back burner for many years. So I think there's a good deal now going into how do we create inventory of units that people can go into quickly on a faster timeline than we've often been able to achieve in the last years.
Okay, great. Senator Johnson.
Would part of that not being vilifying developers and landlords and making it so difficult to have people who want to build rental units? This is a rhetorical question. Or expanding the UGB so that land wasn't so unbelievably expensive in fast-growing areas? I just offer that for consideration. Rather than in here begging for money for shelters, how substantively are we really looking at affordability? We saw some farm worker housing in Boardman at $275,000 a unit. I'd rather have less fancy units and a whole bunch more of them. And I just wonder sometimes, is that getting lost in the conversation? And you don't have to answer.
Okay. Chair, Mr. Chair.
Representative Meek.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the issues I've been told and understand and know is that some of the folks looking for shelter have to be clean and sober before they can get into that. And what programs do we have out there right now helping folks for substance abuse and rehab? You know, because I think it has to go hand in hand. Are there other programs out there for that?
Co-Chair Gumberg, Representative Meek. We have a range of shelter that includes both shelter where sobriety is required, but also what we call low barrier shelter. So people who are not yet in recovery are able to come inside and at least have the safety and start working on their sobriety. In terms of the programs that are available, at least in Multnomah County, we have a number of them through nonprofit partners like Central City Concern, also through our county health department. So there is, and fortunately with the Affordable Care Act, the access to those kinds of resources has actually grown over the last couple of years. But that connecting people into mental health and treatment and addiction recovery services is absolutely vital to the success of people's efforts to get out of homelessness and back on their feet.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to go ahead and excuse this panel. I'm going to call up Elisa Huerta, Aubrey Dixon, and Lisa Harnish.
And welcome.
Co-Chair Gomber, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony to support the Oregon Housing and Community Service Agency budget. My name is Elvis Argueta, also known as Elvis Argueta to some of you, and I am with SEIU. SEIU represents thousands of workers statewide, including the frontline workers at the Oregon Housing and Community Services. The budget proposals have both recommended funding at current service level and also recommended a reduction in support to emergency housing assistance, the state homeless assistance program, and the low-income rental housing fund. The Housing Choice Landlord Guarantee Fund and the Elderly Rental Assistant Housing Stabilization Program. The recipients of these programs are Oregon's most vulnerable community members. Reductions to these programs mean many diverse low-income Oregonians will lose their rental assistance. These programs assist in self-sufficiency and prevent families and individuals from being in a homeless situation. Each of these programs is in high demand and is not funded at the rate to meet the current demand for services. Continuing to allow Oregon to be dead last in corporate taxes is unacceptable. Many social service programs that provide services to low-income Oregonians are being threatened with budget cuts. If the legislature does not make the choice to increase revenue in Oregon and invest in these vital programs, it will result in a devastating impact to the households it currently serves. While funding at CSL is much better than making cut, it still leaves many Oregon families out in the cold without these services. Again, we should be prioritizing investments in programs that lift families up. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Gomber, members of the committee. My name is Aubrey Dixon, and I am here today as chair of the Housing Stability Council. The Housing Stability Council is the governing body for Oregon Housing and Community Services, and our mission is to provide leadership in and review and set policy for housing stability throughout the state of Oregon. In 2015, the Oregon Legislature, through House Bill 2442, renamed the council, clarified its role, and expanded its membership. Today, we are a six-member council, and the governor's office is in the process of adding three additional members to fill our nine-seat charter. I have served as chair since June of 2012. And chair since November of 2014. During my time as chair, the council has worked to position itself to be more effective policy and governance body that provides direction to the agency as it works to address housing needs across Oregon. When I'm not in service for the Housing Stability Council, I am Vice President of Community Development Lending with KeyBank, providing financing options for the development and preservation of affordable housing throughout the western states. I have worked in the affordable housing industry for 14 years and have experienced the highs and lows, the opportunities and challenges, and the abundance and now the shortage of capital to meet the growing demand of affordable housing throughout our state. I joined the council mainly for two reasons. One, as a practitioner in the affordable housing industry, I wanted the opportunity to play a greater role in shaping the direction of affordable housing finance by using my expertise to help address and provide solutions for the lack of affordable housing and the struggle to end homelessness. And second, probably more important, at least to me, is I'm a first-generation Oregonian who happens to be the product of the very housing that OHCS and the Housing Stability Council has worked diligently to provide and preserve throughout the state of Oregon. I have firsthand knowledge that having safe, stable, home is a foundation for families and individuals across Oregon. Today, the department and the council are embarking on a statewide housing plan for the state. We believe this will provide key direction for the agency as we seek to address severe housing challenges across Oregon. As we work to complete that plan, I hope the legislature will make significant and substantial investments in the agency and housing development in order to ensure we continue to make progress towards our goals and address the current crisis. The good work being done by Oregon Housing and Community Services today is providing immediate assistance to people experiencing homelessness and housing instability, to build more affordable homes for people that need them, and to preserve our existing affordable housing stock, a critical resource we cannot afford to lose. In the agency's budget, you have seen that there are requests for more staff positions. I encourage you to give these serious consideration. Having a strong agency with staff who are opening and operating on the mission will be critical to solving our housing crisis. Under the leadership of the previous director, and now under the leadership of Director Salazar, the agency is in positive, substantial internal changes, and now is the time to continue to invest in this agency. I'd also encourage you to give strong consideration to the governor's request for additional investment in the Local Innovation Fast Track, also known as LIFT, Housing Development Program. It even encourage you to consider more than the $60 million in general obligation bonds as proposed by the governor. Particularly today, as there is substantial uncertainty in the federal tax credit market and the proposed cuts to other critical programs such as CDBG and HOME, it is important to invest in the state programs that will increase our supply of affordable housing through innovative strategies. I urge you to act to invest in more affordable homes in Oregon, and as chair of the Housing Stability Council, I have been very excited to see the progress made by the agency in implementation of the LIFT program and to see creative, thoughtful proposals brought to us by developers to use these funds. Thank you again for your time today.
Senator. As a professional, both as a banker and a housing advocate, are we on track, ahead of track, behind track to deploy all the LIFT funds now? The reason that I ask is we only have so much bonding capacity, and I would hate to see some of that tied up now if we can't get the housing stock out the door. And before you answer that, the one other thing I wanted to tell you is how pleased I am to hear you put emphasis on preservation. We don't have to run around and build new everywhere. If we can keep old stuff in stock, that's a terrific thing.
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Johnson. To answer your question, yes, we have a mapped out the milestones for projects to meet readiness to proceed. The one uncertainty that we have, as I mentioned in my remarks, is the tax credit investment market. So many of our LIFT projects are utilizing 4% tax credits. And so the question is going to become how quickly can they shore up their equity investor and close in a reasonable amount of time to be able to, you know, to get those funds out.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Harnish.
All right, great. Thank you very much. Co-chairs Johnson and Gomberg, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be with you here today. For the record, my name is Lisa Harnish, and I'm the executive director of the Marion and Polk Early Learning Hub. I'm here today to speak on behalf of the Housing and Community Services budget and the tremendous impact that this investment has specifically on early learning. Social determinants of health are defined as economic and social conditions that influence the health of people and communities. These are the conditions that make the places where we live, learn, work, and play affect a wide range of health risks and outcomes. As defined by the CDC and Healthy People 2020, social determinants of health include economic stability, education, neighborhood and physical environment, social and community context, and health and health care. All of these determinants are impacted by families having stable, safe housing and access to early learning. Upfront investments in early learning and housing result in healthier families and communities. We know that poverty limits access to healthy foods and safe neighborhoods, and that more education is a predictor of better health. We also know that differences in health are striking in the communities with poor social determinants of health, such as unstable housing, low income, unsafe neighborhoods, or substandard education. And Dr. Thornburg was very eloquent in his remarks in sharing some of the impact of the research that we have on that. By employing what we know about social determinants of health, we can not only improve individual and population health, but also advance health equity. Healthy People 2020 further highlights the importance of addressing social determinants of health by including create social and physical environments that promote good health overall. Between the ages of 0 and 5, the brain develops the most and the fastest. When families with small children are focused on housing and access to food, they're more likely to be unable to adequately support their children in being ready for kindergarten. Kindergarten is tied to third grade reading, and third grade reading scores are tied to graduation rates, which are in result tied to career and success in life. All of this requires us as a state to put in broader approaches that address the social, economic, and environmental factors so that families have access to the basic needs. In the world of early learning, we do our best to support families. As a community, we work hard to leverage the funds to support families in a crisis of being evicted or to meet other emergent needs so that they are able to pay for rent. However, this is not enough. There is a housing crisis in our state, as you well know. We need strong support for housing and preventative services so that the cycle of poverty can be reduced, in best case, eliminated for future generations. Every year, the Marion and Polk County do a point-in-time count of people who were homeless. On that day in 2016, there were 1,537 homeless individuals. 298 of them were children. Local experts estimate that the actual number of people who are homeless is much higher than that. Many studies show that providing permanent supportive housing works. The approach called Housing First is when people are provided housing and supportive services that they can be successful in leaving homelessness, meaning the community benefits from a lower usage of crisis services like emergency room use and police and law involvement. Social and physical health can be improved by providing supportive services. Supportive services and housing can include ensuring children have access to early learning, such as Head Start, areas to play. Families have access to parent education and that health and behavioral health services are located nearby. We know, as you've already heard, that what happens in the earliest months and years and have an impact on the generations to come. We have the ability to make the difference to the current and next generations with this budget. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel? Well, then again, thank you for your sharing your concerns and your interest with us today. I'm going to call Nikki Tersiev, Tom Kemper, and Peter Hanley. Welcome.
Thank you. I will go. Nikki Tersiev here on behalf of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We are a statewide nonprofit that does technical assistance training and certification for nonprofit victim service providers, across the state. We have over 50 members. We also do our best to operate on reservations and within tribal communities. I will keep it very brief. I think one thing that's clear and one thing that's true is that a survivor of domestic violence or sexual violence runs a very high risk and a very high likelihood of being re-victimized without stable housing to move into. Without stable housing, without emergency shelter, things that could be provided by EHA and SHAP, we lose space in the kind of emergency shelters that are held confidential all around the state for safety planning for women and children. If we don't have space in the shelters, then we really have no shelter. So what we're looking at is a ripple effect. Funding through these two funds is going to be critical to not just saving lives and protecting the children, but also making sure that we've got a continuously moving pipeline for safety and security. So we'll urge your support for a significant increase and some more budget dollars going into these two funds, please.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, committee members, my name is Tom Kemper. I'm the Executive Director of Housing Works, which is the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority in Central Oregon, serving Crook, Deschutes, and Jefferson County. We have a portfolio of about 800 units of affordable housing, and we provide rental subsidy to 1,200 families through the Housing Choice Voucher Program. It's really clear that we're in the middle of a very serious housing crisis. We estimate that over 50% of folks in Central Oregon are paying more than 30% of their income for rent. Almost 24% pay more than half of their income for rent. So it's really very, very serious. Vacancy rates are less than 1% in Central Oregon and most of the cities. There clearly is a very significant shortage of affordable housing. And so we're very much sort of driven to provide additional units of affordable housing in the community. We have 100 units currently in development, under construction, and we actually received LIFT funding for two projects, one's in Sisters and one's in Lapine, two smaller communities that Lapine hasn't seen any family affordable housing at all. So it's you know, LIFT is providing those funds. The difficulty in doing affordable housing is that it costs just as much to build an affordable housing unit as it does a market unit. And yet, because your rents are 25 to 50% lower, you know, you don't have the sources of debt and regular funds to actually create those, you know, to build those units. And so, you know, most of the housing that's been built across the nation, actually, is with low-income housing tax credits. So the 9% tax credit program is sort of the, you know, it is what really drives affordable housing throughout the country. Now, in Oregon, we get a reservation that'll support maybe 10 to 12 projects a year across the entire state. Now, we've been lucky. We've been able to get a reservation the last couple years. But it's not enough, obviously. And 4% tax credits are a strong resource, but you need additional gap money, and that's where LIFT really comes in. The two of the projects we have currently going have significant funding through from OHCS in addition to 4% tax credits in the form of GHAP funding and a slug of really construction excise tax from the city of Bend. It was over $1 million from the city. The two projects that we were proposing, well, we actually have in development that we expect to start construction on this summer in Sisters and Lapine, are dependent on the LIFT funding. You know, that's the gap money in the deal, and we hope to start those this summer. So I'm urging you to really support the LIFT program, because, you know, 9% tax credits aren't enough to develop the housing that we need in Oregon, and frankly, even the 4% tax credit isn't enough, and whatever additional gap money that you can provide is really very, very significant to get those projects built. You know, we really urge your support of Oregon Housing. They've been great partners, and without them, there would be no affordable housing in the state. Thank you.
Senator.
Why Sisters? One of the most expensive sets of real estate in the state, with no significant industry there. Those are mostly service sector jobs. It isn't like there's a big sawmill there. Why Sisters?
It's about the people who work in the restaurants and work in the gas stations and the grocery stores and the banks. You know, there's... That is exactly the problem. There is no affordable housing in Sisters other than 33 units of that we own in that city, and yet there's, you know, people are commuting into Sisters because there's no affordable place to live, and it's because it is one of the most affluent communities in Central Oregon, and the cost of real estate is so high, but, you know, normal people they can't afford to live there. And so all the more important to get some affordable housing into that community. The city actually, the small city of Sisters is putting $300,000 into this transaction to make it go. They have been pushing us to build affordable housing there for a long time. So,
thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Johnson and Gomberg, and members of the committee. My name is Peter Hanley. I'm Executive Director of CASA of Oregon. That stands for Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation, not court-appointed special advocates, and we do plenty of housing throughout the state, originally starting with farm worker housing and I'll get back to your boardman in a separate conversation with you, Senator. But we also provide individual development accounts throughout the state, working with public housing authorities, community development corporations, other nonprofits to offer IDAs to victims of domestic violence, to folks coming out of the prison system, and then to the folks that are participating in programs with the housing authority. We do a lot of preservation work throughout the state. A lot of it is U.S. Department of Agricultural Rural Development 515. Today I'm here to talk about our preservation work in manufactured housing communities. About 10 years ago, 12 years ago, John Van Landingham traveled back to New Hampshire to look at a resident-owned co-op model. We brought that back here to Oregon, passed a number of laws to put that into place. To date, we've converted 9 parks throughout the states into resident-owned manufactured housing communities. Senator Johnson and I sat down with a group of folks last year to talk about some of the challenges facing the folks in these parks. A couple of these parks, there's one that's in our first one, is in Representative Nobles in McMinnville. We've done one out in Boardman, and we're working on one in Gladstone right now as we speak. So phase one is really preserving the land because the folks still need to, if they have a house payment, they still need to pay that. But at least we can take the guests out of the park being transferred to somebody else and that stress level going up. And so we're there to help them. We help them put the financing package together, and we work with them long term to make sure that they can own it and operate it as a resident co-op. So that's really the phase one. Once we do that, phase two is what we'd like to start doing some replacement of those units, because a lot of these houses are very old, not energy efficient at all, and very, in many cases, unsafe, unsanitary. So when I hear Senator Johnson talk about some of the dollars sloshing around in ETO and trying to go to Energy Trust of Oregon and figure out how can we match those with existing subsidies through Federal Home Loan Bank or through utilities or through money that the state has, there's some opportunities out there to really get the costs down. If you look on OLIS, I put together some preservation statistics of the 9 parks that we've done and 3 that we currently have underway. And you'll see in there, it's really a very cost-effective way of preserving these units. They range from about $20,000 for a park down in Gold Beach up to $65,000 for a park in Clackamas. And so you can see there that it's a really cost-effective way. So thank you, and I hope you will support the department's budget.
Thank you all. Any questions for this group? All right. Again, thank you for your presentations today. I'm going to call Jacob
thank
Fox.
You.
You're very welcome. Jacob Fox, Bob Weiss, and Emily Ryman. Welcome to you all.
Great. Thanks. My name is Jacob Fox. I'm the executive director of the Housing and Community Services Agency of Lane County. We're Lane County's housing authority. Co-Chair Gomper, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members, it's an honor to be before you today, and I just want to start with a sincere and compassionate thank you to all of you and the OHCS staff members that are in the room. You are making a difference, and I want to give an example or two. The LIFT commitment that you made is bringing units on the ground in communities that have a housing crisis, so you've made a difference. The EHA funding that you included in your last legislative session has allowed us to do something unique in Lane County that I wanted to inform you of. We've been able to hire a landlord liaison that's out working with our landlords and educating them about housing homeless people, and that's a really specific example of something that's making a big difference in our community, thanks to you. The need, as you know, is great, and I'm going to spend a minute on the need. I am talking today about preservation, and preservation is a huge deal for us as a housing authority. We own 700 public housing units. We have another 800 affordable housing units, and we provide 2,700 Section 8 vouchers. But our public housing portfolio and the need to preserve those across the state is of great importance. I'll give you an example. We serve not just Springfield and Eugene, we serve all of Lane County. I have a building that's over 40 years old in Cottage Grove. It's full of elderly and disabled people that need our support. And this winter, because of the rising flood table from an adjacent river, both elevators went down because of the old systems that exist in that building. We had maintenance staff carrying groceries and helping elderly people up and down the stairwells. And I really am grateful for their service, but it just is an example of a challenge that we have to face together. I have another building in Eugene, Parkview Terrace. It just celebrated its 50th year anniversary. Normally that would be something you would celebrate, and we did. But as I delivered a meal to an elderly person on the fourth floor, I just am struck by the need to reinvest in that asset. So I just want to wholeheartedly say that the OHCS budget and the preservation part of that budget is really critical to our community and every community across the state. And I want to start, as housing professionals, as elected officials, we need to start thinking about these buildings and this challenge like infrastructure. Our roads, our sewers, and our public housing all need our attention and our reinvestment. And with that, I would just close again, thanking you for your service and thanking you for what you do in our community.
Well, thank you very much.
Co-Chair Gomberg, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Emily Ryman. I'm the executive director of NEDCO, which is a nonprofit CDC that serves Lane, Marion, and Clackamas counties. I'm here today to speak in support of the budget request items from OHCS that support specifically first-time homeownership programs, and also to ask for the restoration of funds to support foreclosure counseling programs. For the last two biennia, the legislature has allocated funding to support foreclosure counseling for families entering the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Program. That funding was zeroed out of the governor's budget this year, and we have grave concerns about that funding ending this quickly. We know that the economy and the housing market in Oregon are in recovery, but we also know that that recovery has not reached all parts of the state yet, and it certainly hasn't reached all homeowners in Oregon yet. The OFA mediation program continues to get about 600 new families per month referred into that program, so potentially thousands of families over the course of the next biennia, and we have seen those numbers stay stable for quite a long time now. Unfortunately, all the federal dollars for foreclosure counseling have already been eliminated, so these state dollars are the only ones we have, and if they're eliminated, then foreclosure counseling effectively shuts down in this state as of July 1, and homeowners referred into that program in the next biennium would not have the support that they need to be able to sit down and negotiate with their lender. This is a program that we know works. The success rate continues to be more than 70%. We actually have a homeowner here this afternoon to tell you about his experience receiving counseling for that program. I would encourage you to restore funding to the OHCS budget for that program. Switching gears to first-time homeownership, we all know that first-time homeownership, especially for low- and moderate-income families, is becoming harder and harder. With several decades of stagnant wages, unfortunately, home prices have risen that whole time. In recent years, they have started to skyrocket, and we have a basic disconnect between the income that low-income and working-class families are making and the money it takes to get into a modest home. The tools we have at OHCS, including the Regional Housing Center funding, individual development accounts, down payment assistance, and the Single Family Bond Program, are some of the most powerful tools we have to help working class families get into homeownership for the first time. Without those tools, we risk setting up a generation of low income families to not be able to afford the tool we know will best help them out of poverty and into the middle class. So I would urge you to support those first time homeownership programs in the budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, Senator.
I don't want to ask a disrespectful question, but there's no way to dress it up. One of the conversations that's been going around the building here is about the programs that are using the mortgage counseling dollars and have now embedded those in their own base budgets, and that there's a reliance on the part of the 501c3s or the other non-governmental organizations for that money to be able to run your operation. Any validity to that criticism?
I can only speak for NEDCO, but I know at our program and any other nonprofits with which I'm familiar, that funding supports foreclosure counselors.
I didn't get that.
So if that funding goes away, then the foreclosure counselors are, that program is eliminated, but it doesn't support other operations at our nonprofit.
Thank you.
Ms. Ryman, talk to me for just a moment about the demand for foreclosure assistance. Is the level the same as it has been in the past?
It's not, pardon me, it's not the same as it was at its height. We definitely see it trend down a little bit. About a year ago, we saw it trend down maybe a third from its height, and unfortunately, we saw it plateau right there. So those numbers that are less than they were at the height have stayed steady. And I would say, you know, we fully expect eventually for this program to wind down and for the numbers to get small enough that it really is time to think about the program sunsetting, but it just isn't yet. We're seeing the demand stay really consistent for now, and we want to make sure that homeowners who are in that position have the support that they need. Foreclosure is so expensive for a family and for a community, and with a relatively small investment, we can help prevent a lot of those.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Corman, and members of the committee. I'm Bob Weiss, for the record, and I'm the problem. I don't have a title. I don't have the solution. I'm one of the people who needs assisted living, and I thought I'd come before you. They said I could, and tell you kind of what it was for me and how assisted living has actually helped me. When I retired in 2002, my retirement was around $1,000, and apartments in Eugene for that price were studios, and they were running at around $600 or $700, which didn't leave me a lot else, what else to do. And someone mentioned Eupaula, which is a landmark in Eugene. My parents moved to Eugene just when Eupaula was going up. And it has 200 and some units, 200 and I've got it written down, 222 units. One bedroom apartments, they're simple. I mean, it's not fancy. They're simple apartments or they're studio apartments, but they're well maintained and they make you feel safe. And I don't know about you, but I know that one of the things that people share when they get to be my age is they want safety. We're very vulnerable to muggings, to all sorts of things. And if I'm renting an apartment on my own income, I'm going to rent it in one of the poor parts of Eugene and one of the higher crime rates of Eugene. I'm just begging for it. The second thing that most of us want are the services that come from, you know, for our age. And it's very hard to get those kind of services if you're on your own. But like at Eupaula, we have a coordinator that can hook me up with certain services that will fit me. So we want services. And the other thing, it's a lonely business being old. It's not for sissies. And there's a social networking that you can do. So, like, it does provide, this is what it has provided for me. It's provided this little community. But like old things, it went up in 64 when I was 24. You know, I'm 76 now, and my plumbing's not so good either, and either is Eupaula's. But instead of tearing this thing down and putting these 220-some people at risk for going through this sort of stuff and losing not affordable housing. It's not affordable housing to me. It's my home.
I always get a little upset about that. You know, all of us hate to be a number or a figure or crunched, and I hate to be crunched into affordable housing. But I will tell you that I'm an old man that needs assistance. You know, we don't think it's so bad about stairs, but when we get down to the real nitty-gritty of living, it's really hard to ask for assistance. So I hope that you will entertain this. The preservation thing is really important because this building can, if it's not brought up, I have a word down here, I have to say the word approval. We have an approval thing coming up for HUD. If the building isn't up to snuff, we lose that. And then it'll be sold probably to some private person, and then you'll have expensive apartments. Sorry I rambled. Sorry I got emotional.
Questions? Sorry you're here, sir. Senator.
Who would be, and maybe this is a better question asked to some of the development professionals in the room, but who would be the kind of entity, or what would be the kind of entity that would take over the refurbishment of a
facility? We've got that. Do you have their name?
As far as the development company that would work on this, the Housing Development Center is who's coordinating the effort on the Poe Terrace preservation.
Okay. Just for the record, I don't know if the microphone's picked it up. You said the Housing Development Center?
Yes.
Housing Development Center, yeah.
Co-Chair Gombrich?
Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gombrich. Just wanted to lend credibility and anecdotal, I guess, my own experience in the real estate market to Ms. Ryman's testimony that I spent years understanding working with foreclosure short sales, and this year alone, the last couple of years, I have had to work with clients that either there's not enough money at the end of the month and they find themselves in trouble and they need this counseling services and opportunities in order to qualify for other grants and funds that will help them to refinance or to keep stay in their home. So there, I agree, it's very prevalent still and very needed. So thank you. Yeah.
Any other comments or questions for this group? Thank you all very much for being with us today. Our final panel is Efren Gabriel, Quinn Collins, and Allison McIntosh. And is there anybody else here who had intended to testify that did not get signed up in any of our sheets? All right, then this will be our final panel. Welcome.
Thank you to the senators and the members of the committee for giving me the opportunity to tell my testimony. My name is Efren Gabriel. I'm from Salem. I was victim of a fraud from a company that's supposed to help me reduce my mortgage. I was recommended to NETCO, a nonprofit organization that helped me get through the with my mortgage problems. They guide me with all the paperwork, and they got me through to mediation under the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program. Without this program, I would have lost my home. I would recommend or propose to restore funding to keep the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program available, not just for me, but for other families to be able to keep their homes. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
How long ago did you go through the foreclosure counseling?
About 6 months.
Okay, and you're still in your home, and you're on track to be able to stay there?
Yeah, they put me on track.
Thank you.
And it did help me a lot.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Quinn Collins, and I work with College Dreams in Southern Oregon. You heard last week about the asset building program that Oregon Housing Community Services administers, the Oregon Individual Development Account Initiative. College Dreams is fortunate to partner with the initiative, and I have the pleasure of working with students as young as 12 while they save towards their education, earn matching funds, build financial resilience, and create hope for their futures. Individual Development Accounts, or IDAs, are match savings accounts that qualifying Oregonians with lower incomes can enroll in through one of the many partners located in all corners of the state. Participants save for a defined goal, receive support and training from initiative partners, such as home buying, education, or business plan development, and in addition, receive coaching as they shift their financial habits. When participants reach their savings goal, their savings are matched with initiative resources to purchase their home, education, small business inventory, or other asset. Through our partnership with the Oregon IDA Initiative, College Dreams has enrolled more than 500 youth in IDAs that are low-income, underrepresented, and first-generation. By working with youth as young as 12, we benefit from national research that shows that youth with as little as $500 in an account dedicated towards college are 3 times as likely to enroll in post-secondary and 4 times as likely to graduate. This last year, as an example of that, 100% of the seniors that we served graduated from high school and 96% enrolled in post-secondary education or training. Through our IDA program, we're able to build long-term relationships with students and their families, and we can be flexible and responsive to the needs that they individually have. This last week, I actually had the opportunity to Skype with one of our students that is attending Portland State University and currently studying abroad in South Korea. He reflected on the day that we first met and invited him into the program. And he said to me, which I had to go back and replay because he let me record it, is he said, "We had no clue how college or any of that really worked, let alone how we could afford to get into one." I'd gotten to the point where I'd accepted the fact that I'd never go to university or achieve any of my dreams of traveling and leading an exciting life abroad. It was my I was convinced that I was fated to stay here and never make anything out of myself, but instead you came to me out of the blue and pretty much told me all my dreams could come true. That was probably one of the best days of my life. After that day, we enrolled him in the IDA program, and he started saving towards his education. We helped him prepare to make that happen. We took him on campus visits, advised him on classes, helped him navigate the FAFSA, college and scholarship application processes. He ended up enrolling in Rogue Community College after he graduated from high school and then transferred to Portland State University after 2 years. Because of his IDA, he built the skills necessary to navigate managing his finances, and he's on track to graduate with less than a third of the average national student loan debt and is going to be the first student or the first child in his family to graduate from college. So I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to share about the program and the pathways to opportunity that it creates for Oregonians and communities across the state.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Gomberg, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Allison McIntosh, and I'm here today on behalf of the Housing Alliance. I'm going to be very brief. I know you're running out of time. I just wanted to express our strong support for the department's budget and House Bill 5012 and talk about a few of our key priorities that are enclosed in this budget. You've already heard much of what we're talking about today from the real experts, the people that deliver these services on the ground. So I'll just run through these very quickly. The Housing Alliance is very supportive of a few priorities in particular. First, increased investments in the Emergency Housing Account and State Homeless Assistance Program, also known as EHA and SHAP, which provide needed support to prevent and end homelessness across Oregon. These dollars have been critical at helping to meet basic needs for shelter all across the state. Second, the Local Innovation and Fast Track Housing Development Program, or LIFT. We were very excited to see the awards that the department made in January of this year to build 965 units with the $40 million allocated by the legislature in 2015. The governor's budget proposes an additional investment of $60 million. We're asking for your consideration for an investment of $100 million this biennium to really infuse our state with a badly needed supply of safe and stable homes. We're particularly excited by this program. We think it provides us an opportunity to think differently as a state outside the box, to try some new things, and also to help leverage the federal 4% tax credits. Third, as you know, we have long worked to preserve existing affordable housing across Oregon. It's really important as we work to increase the supply that we also keep every available home that we have and keep it affordable. Based on projections of need across the state to preserve housing with federal rent subsidies, to preserve public housing, and to preserve manufactured home parks, we're requesting that you consider an investment of $100 million to meet those needs across the state. Lastly, the Oregon Foreclosure Avoidance Program. You have invested in this key program since 2011 to provide access to counseling and legal services for people facing foreclosure. For people that do access counseling, as you heard, their outcomes are extremely successful, with over 70% of them coming to some agreement with their lender to keep their homes. And lastly, I just want to express our strong support for the department's request for additional staff capacity. We believe it's critical that we support this agency to provide leadership, technical assistance, and essential staff resources as they work to achieve their mission. Thank you so much for your time today and for your service.
Thank you. Yes, Senator.
I was once a citizen lobbyist, and I know it's important to be aspirational and shoot high, but when I got your summary sheet, the question that jumped into my mind was, are they unaware of the budget situation? Have you given serious thought to a more realistic downsizing of what it is the legislature would be able to provide for you? You're asking for over $200 million.
Co-Chair Johnson, yes, thank you very much for the question. We talked a lot about this as a membership when we were putting together our agenda, and part of what my members and I discussed throughout our agenda setting process was the need to reflect the needs that we see in communities to you. We felt it would be a disservice to simply say, we know there's no money for housing, everything's fine, we'll just go on about our merry way. I think we're happy to come and discuss further some more realistic numbers with you.
I take exception to your characterization that that I thought everything is fine. Everything isn't fine, but we're between $1.8 and $2 billion upside down, and your organization has worked so hard to build credibility in this building that when I saw it, I just was sort of taken aback. At least it sounds as though there was a rationale for why you did your presentation the way you did, and that there would be a willingness to look at something that was more obtainable.
Coach Johnson, my apologies. I know you know that there's a problem. I did not mean to imply that. I misspoke.
Good. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Again, thank you all. And again, is there anybody else in the audience that wanted to testify that didn't get a chance to? Well, if not, I particularly want to thank the people that that joined us today that have firsthand experience with the programs we're discussing. I want to thank the advocates that have come forward. I'd like to thank the department for their several days of presentations. And I'll thank the committee members. You House members know my personal feelings on the seriousness of the subject that's before us. I think the only people I won't thank are our federal government because the news we received at the beginning of our hearings on 5012 that we're looking at $112 million of additional cuts in programs that we've relied on in the past, making this situation just that much more dire. So I'm going to go ahead and conclude the hearing on House Bill 5012. Ms. Deister, you're going to be leaving us for a while, and we're going to be talking about transportation for the rest of the week.
This is correct, but I will be back in the middle of the week after next.
Well,
so
I know you'll be thinking about us.
Not gone for long.
All right. Anything else for the good of the order, colleagues? Then we are adjourned.